welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope you had a wonderful weekend. Today, we take a deep dive into two captivating cultural highlights that showcase the rich artistic and historical tapestry of Grand Forks. Coming up a little bit later today, folk musician and storyteller Tom Brousseau takes us back in time with an excerpt from the Great American Folk Show that we air on Saturdays at 5 p.m. right here on Prairie Public. Tom features music from around the world, and today he'll share tales from what was and is the historic Grand Forks Metropolitan Opera House. And we begin today's Main Street with a conversation with the North Dakota Museum of Art. They're hosting a new exhibition, Women at War, along with an opening reception that will include a talk by Anne Kingsbury, whose exhibition, Slow Improvisations, A Frame of Mind, is currently on display in the Mezzanine Gallery. The public is invited to the reception for their newest exhibition on Thursday, January 16th at 4:30. It goes from 4:30 to 6:30, and joining me to discuss, Anna Arner. She's the curator of the North Dakota Museum of Art. Anna, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
We're looking forward to visiting with Anne Kingsbury here in just a little bit, but let's open with you. Tell me, Women at War, it features works by contemporary women artists from Ukraine. Do I have that right?
Yes. 12 contemporary artists, and I should say one of the 12 is a historical figure. He actually died in 1970, but the curator of the exhibition, Monica Fabianza, thought it would be important to include her. Her name is Ala Horska. The remaining 11 are contemporary artists, and all of them actually very well known. They have widely exhibited internationally. Some of them have had some showings here in the U.S., but what I'm really excited about is it's really the first group exhibition focusing on Ukrainian art. There's been some historical exhibits about 20th century figures, but this is the first time in U.S. soil that we've brought together contemporary living Ukrainian artists.
This exhibition was created really in response to Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine and the ongoing conflict. How do you think these pieces will help viewers then be able to better understand the emotional and social dimensions of this horrible war?
So a few kind of contextual remarks about that. So this exhibit, prior to coming here, I mean, its first venue was at the Fridman Gallery in New York in 2022, and it was done in collaboration with the Volson Gallery in Kyiv, and now based in Miami. And the curator for this exhibition, Monica Fabianza, she actually had worked on a different show. She had been hired by Fridman to work on something entirely different. But when the war broke out, he approached Monica and said, "We need to do something." He himself is Russian, actually, and he felt really strongly about this. Monica, who is actually Polish, did not want to take it on initially, and she openly admits this for a number of reasons. But through a series of conversations, they decided it was the right thing to do, because art, after all, is a way, it serves as a kind of catalyst for important conversation. So she took an impossible task, because she had only 3 months to curate this international exhibition. And so she worked just seriously to make it happen. And I should add that there were additional complexities. Ukraine, because it was at war, was completely shut down. So it's not as if you had SEDEX operating. Normally museums and galleries, make arrangements for international shipping. And so a lot of the work had to be taken out of Ukraine through unconventional means. Monica is Polish. Some of the work he received when she was in Poland visiting family, and so others brought it to the Ukrainian-Polish border, and she got it that way. Other work came to her through the Venice Biennale, which is a huge international exhibition. And so it just took on incredible courage and a lot of logistical planning. And yes, because this is not just a simple gathering of 12 artists, you had to do a lot of research. That's some of the context that I wanted to give there. But about, wrapping back to your question, about half of the pieces in the exhibition are about the current conflict that, started in 2022. The other half point back to earlier conflict, such as the time period when Russia annexed Crimea and also makes references to the separatist But even more broadly, there are echoes and direct references to the two world wars, as well as the so-called Holodomor, which was the systematic starvation of millions of Ukrainians that was inflicted upon them during Joseph Stalin's reign. And for decades, this was an episode in Ukrainian history that you were not allowed to talk about. It was not mentioned in history books. Russian bureaucrats actively censored it, and actually it was forbidden to talk about. So this exhibit, while of course it obviously is very poignant because it's about the current war, really takes on some powerful kind of historical questions. And, you know, the show often brings up the term historiography, which is about how history is written. It's about the method and the values. And even more broadly, and the many of the artists ask us, who writes history, right? Who has the right to write history? Which voices are left out? And a lot of what is happening in this show is to, in the words of one artist, Donna Cavallina, to shed light on the so-called blind spot. What are those things, where are those voices that haven't really been heard? And this includes not just, you know, women's experiences, but children's experiences, the experiences of the elderly, the disabled, you know, marginalized populations such as the Roma. And so I guess, you know, what I'm trying to emphasize here is this is not just a topical one-off exhibition, but it really brings so much to the table.
We're enjoying our conversation with Anna Arner. She's the curator of the North Dakota Museum of Art. The museum is hosting a new exhibition, Women at War, and the public is invited to a reception. That's this Thursday, January 16th, from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. at the museum. In just a moment, we'll also visit with artist Anne Kingsbury. Anna, tell me this about the exhibition. It draws parallels, doesn't it, between Ukraine's fight for independence and also the fight for gender equality. You spoke about blind spots. Women are often absent, really, from historical accounts of war. Is that an accurate message, do you think, that these parallels send to viewers?
Yeah. I mean, as I mentioned in my earlier, this is not just, you know, putting a spotlight on women's experiences of war, but traditionally what is not really covered in accounts of war. And I'm not just talking about history books, but also in, you know, media coverage. And so many of the artists want to kind of spotlight that, you know, the experiences of marginalized voices. But it's also highlighting themes or events that take place not just on the battle scene, but, you know, the everyday reality of simply surviving. Some of them even talk about the kind of mundane aspects of day-to-day life. Some of the works were actually produced while living in bunkers, right, or in war zones. And so, you know, as an art historian, you know, I'm very well versed with, you know, famous paintings about the war. You know, I think about Picasso's Guernica, or, you know, Goya's painting of, you know, Napoleon's, you know, invasion throughout Europe, including Spain. Or, you know, you think back to ancient Rome, you know, you have generals and emperors on horseback. And many traditional artworks about war are about the triumph. Right. This talks about other aspects of war, as I mentioned, not just the everyday reality, but also the trauma. Several pieces talk about the toll of mental health on people enduring lengthy occupations, as well as, you know, being in direct line of fire. But I also want to say here that this is not just about victimhood. Many of the pieces offer really empowering messages about agency, having power. You might be victimized, but how can you flip the script? And so, like I said, there's just a lot to unpack here.
Why was it important for you as curator to bring this exhibition here to North Dakota?
So, as Monica will attest, when I met her a few years ago, I was working on another project dealing with artists in conflict zones, so not just Ukraine, but broader. And so I had found out about her exhibition, and I looked at where it was, and at that time, it was just the East and the West Coast. And so I said, Monica, how is it that this show is not going to the places that are home to some of the largest populations of Ukrainian immigrants? And so, you know, through diligence, and I kept prodding her, she added three more venues, one in Chicago, which is the largest home to Ukrainian immigrants, as well as Manitoba. And even before I started working here at the North Dakota Museum of Art, I approached them and I said, I think we should do this show. And they agreed. And so my thought was not just to appeal immediately to, you know, our kind of Ukrainian roots that we have here in our state. But also, I would say, and I include myself here, I think in general, many Americans don't know a lot about Eastern European history. If we know about European history, we might know about France and Germany or our engagement through the two world wars. But the countries in Eastern Europe, we just don't know as much. And this really tells us a lot about that, both about their fight for independence, but also their time period as being Soviet Republic. And so I just think it brings a lot of value. And then it also speaks to universal experience. You know, some of the best art that is made speaks to human experience, and that includes trauma, death, struggle, but also like flipping the script, trying to find ways to have, to empower yourself, to have agency in times of great duress.
Later in February, you'll have 2 days of programming related to this show. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we're very excited. So the curator that I've mentioned more than once, Monica Fabianska, we are bringing her in and she'll be giving a talk in the museum that will be on February 27th at 4 p.m. And that will be followed by a Q&A. The following day, we will be screening some films by two of the artists featured in the exhibition. And that's going to take place at the Empire Art Center in Grand Forks. And we're very excited. One of the films, which is by, will receive its North American premiere in that evening. It's a brand new film. And it's called All Good. After that, we're going to film two films by Donna Cavallina. We have one of her films in the museum, but these are two additional ones. And so we'll have a screening. Both artists are going to have a brief pre-recorded introduction. They will be joining us from Ukraine via Zoom to participate in discussion after the screening. And we have Dr. Christoph Wall-Romana of the University of Minnesota, who's going to serve as moderator for that evening. And so we're really excited to do this. There's one other thing that we'll do in March. The museum has a classical music series. And on March 23rd, we're bringing in a pianist and a violinist, Rebecca Dinnerstein and Rebecca Fisher. And they're going to be playing some pieces by Ukrainian composers. It won't be the whole concert, but they're going to select some pieces. So there'll be ways to kind of extend and expand our thinking about this exhibition.
The new exhibition that the North Dakota Museum of Art is titled Women at War. The museum will be hosting a reception that will include a talk from my next guest, Anne Kingsbury, whose exhibition, Flow Improvisations, A Frame of Mind, is currently on display in the mezzanine gallery. The public is invited to a reception this Thursday, January 16th, from 4:30 to 6:30. Anna Arner has been my guest. She is the curator of the North Dakota Museum of Art. Thank you, Anna, for joining us again on Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. It was a pleasure.
And it's my pleasure to be joined by Wisconsin resident Anne Kingsbury. She is an artist and community activist and taught at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee before co-founding the Woodland Pattern Book Center in 1979. Since then, she has been the manager of this nonprofit literary arts center, which features the most comprehensive collection of small press poetry for resale in the country. Anne, it's a pleasure having you with us on Main Street.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here.
Your exhibit, Slow Improvisations, A Frame of Mind, is currently on display in the Mezzanine Gallery. Tell me about the exhibit, Anna. How does your work incorporate things like beadwork, leather, and fabric, along with text from your journals?
Well, it started with text work, journal work, but I've always wanted to be a beader, although I'm self-taught. So it started out with keeping journal, of daily activity done with a timer. This was a solution to a kind of a bad patch in my life, and you couldn't really feel like you'd accomplished anything. So in order to remind myself what I accomplished, my husband gave me a journal, and I started writing things down like 10 minutes, wash your hair, or 5 minutes, brush fangs, or 15 minutes, do the dishes. And it wasn't a list of things to do. It was a contract with a period of time that you were willing to spend on that. So when the timer went off, And I am a devotee of the timer, and I could quit doing whatever it was I didn't want to do and go on to something else maybe. Well, I kept those for a year, and because just the way the journals went, they weren't linear. They were shapes on different pages, and in between the shapes, I would do a drawing or something. So I had kept several journals, and then I was having an exhibition, and I felt like I wanted to show some other stuff, and I was talking with Carl, that's my husband, and I said, you know, I think I'm going to be a little short on this exhibition. And he said, well, why don't you do your journal pages? And I said, oh, come on, they're just journal pages. And he said, take a look at them. And I looked at them, and I'd been doing them for years. And I thought, all these years I've been making this stuff, and it's an art form, and I didn't even know it. It was just a survival technique. So the journal pages turned into, what can I do that's even slower? Because I like working slow. So I thought, I can bead some of these pages, or I can bead journal entries. And that's where it all came from.
Is it your hope, Anne, that your work inspires viewers who are looking at your work to reflect, I guess, on their own multifaceted lives?
Absolutely. Because we may think we're only doing one thing, but if you step back, you see there's lots of stuff going on in your life that you didn't even realize you were doing until you write it down. Now, everybody doesn't have to write it down. That's just my compulsiveness, but I find it very helpful.
Give me an idea or perhaps a sense of what people will see when they come up to your work at the North Dakota State Art Museum.
Well, I believe that the beaded deer hide is in the exhibition, and that is one journal entry from 1975, until I finished it in 2022. So, and it would be a series of what looked like list form of what was happening that day, but one day from each year. And in between, there would be drawings again. So it would be, and I tried to be not quite so repetitious because every day starts with the same stuff, but, you know, like deboned turkey. Only you start with the time, 30 minutes deboned turkey, and then that probably would be a November entry or something along those lines, as well as the good, faithful ones, brush bangs and comb hairs and, you know, daily stuff like that.
Do you still use those techniques today to help you journey through life, Anne?
I go back and forth on the journal. Sometimes I don't need them, but lately I've found it very helpful to remind myself what I'm doing again, and it works just fine. Because now I know that I'm also building pages as well as making these little contracts. And I enjoy having the timer going on.
Today's world is full of technology, and many artists use technology. You keep your hands active to create that direct connection with the materials that you use. Is this hands-on approach impacting, well, I guess, the emotional depth of your work?
I can't tell you what it ends up being, but emotionally, because it's using your first tool, to me the first tool for your hand, maybe your head too, but definitely your hand, and you're not having other things get in the way of what your hand is doing. So you're not doing layers of stuff. My hand pushes a button which causes something else happen. No, the hand is actually doing the bead work, and it's my I like the time it takes, because while you're doing it with your hand, your mind is going faster. And you might be seeing other solutions or just thinking about other stuff. It's a very enriching process because it allows you to think while you're working. And again, I enjoy that a lot.
You also use quilts, doll, pot holders. And does this challenge or reinforce societal expectations of women in your work?
Well, I used to consider myself in disguise because people would say, well, what do you do? And I'd say, well, I make dolls. And I could just see what they were thinking. Oh, yeah, okay. Or I do beadwork. And again, there's a preconceived idea of what that is. My dolls are anatomically correct, which sometimes causes a little stir. Not so much anymore, but it did. And the time it takes to do the doll with stitching pieces, you know, of the body together, or the time it takes to do the beadwork, because each bead is a pixel. Each bead is making its little bead present up to a line or a text or a word. So you have to listen to the bead. You can't just string them together and not pay attention. The nice thing is you can always take it out. You can forgive yourself. The beads will forgive you. and you can do it over again.
We're enjoying our conversation with Anne Kingsbury. Her exhibit is on display as we speak at the North Dakota Museum of Art. Anne, tell me, how did you create your relationship with the North Dakota Museum of Art? Why is your exhibit on display today?
I mean, there's many, many people who've had something to do with this, but the first person who made it possible is Laurel Reuter, because I met Laurel years ago, and she came to our house to visit while she was in Milwaukee, and we hit it off. We both love books. She likes looking at my work. She likes seeing our library. We had a very good conversation. And then some years passed. And then I got an invitation to be part of an exhibition that she had put together at the museum. And I asked her if she'd like to see how the deer hide had been in progress, because she'd seen it before. And she was very, very interested in that, very supportive. So we kept in loose contact until she saw the deer hide when it was almost done. And the museum acquired the deer hide, thanks to Laurel. And that was the start, I think, of the beginning's possibility for this exhibition.
Anne Kingsbury's exhibition is titled Slow Improvisations, A Frame of Mind. It's currently on display in the Mezzanine Gallery at the North Dakota Museum of Art. And just a reminder, their newest exhibit, Women at War, will have an opening reception that includes the talk by Anne Kingsbury. Anne, what are you going to tell folks at the opening reception this Thursday?
Well, I'm going to answer questions for one thing, and then I'll try to give them a little background on process, because to me, process is extremely important, since it's with your hand. And then how the process changes itself into the actual object, because each object tells a little story. And I'm not conscious of it, but the stories are there, and people tell me the story. And sometimes they're different than the ones I think that are there.
Our thanks to Anna Arner. She's a curator of the North Dakota Museum of Art. We spoke to her earlier today, and to my current guest, Anne Kingsbury. She'll be available to answer your questions Thursday, January 16th, from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. She'll talk about her current exhibition, Flow Improvisation, A Frame of Mind, that's currently on display at the museum. Thank you, Anne, so much for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you very much, Craig.
I first became a member of Prairie Public when we moved back to North Dakota in 2007. We are members of Prairie Public because we love to listen to the diverse programming. We particularly love the Moth Radio Hour, StoryCorps, and just the different diverse perspectives. I have many driveway moments listening to Prairie Public, particularly with the Moth Radio Hour. I just can't seem to tear myself away without hearing how the story ends. And I just love the complete picture that Prairie Public paints for stories that are presented. I love the sustaining membership option of Prairie Public because it allows me to think about one less thing. I know that I'm contributing to Prairie Public every month, and it's not something I have to think about. I love knowing that my family and I are contributing to Prairie Public to help maintain the stories that you hear. I'm Erica Berg from Kindred, North Dakota, and I'm a proud sustaining member of Prairie Public.
Support all the things you love about Prairie Public by making a sustaining membership contribution. It's easy. Just go to prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145.
Coming up after the break, Tom Brousseau. He's the host of the Great American Folk Show here on Prairie Public, and he'll channel the music and maybe even some of the ghosts from an old building in the city that shaped him. That's Grand Forks. That's coming up here on Main Street. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation. Proud to partner with Strengthen ND to announce the 2024 Bush Prize North Dakota winners, North Dakota Native Vote, and North Dakota Assistive. More information online at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Call Tom Brousseau not only a world-class folk musician, but an old soul sleuth of North Dakota history. On his Great American Folk Show, which airs Saturday at 5 p.m. Central right here on Prairie Public, not only will you hear music from around the world, but the stories of Main Streets that run through the center of our towns, big and small. Today, Tom channels the music and maybe even some of the ghosts from an old building in the city that shaped him.
There's a place in my hometown that once was an opera house. It's still there, in fact, after 134 years. But now it's kind of empty. I say kind of empty because it is available for private functions, and some people rent flats on the second floor. Back when I was growing up, it was the Uptown Bar and a place for Central High School students to bowl. They did their bowling there. Yes, somewhere in the back of that old opera house, there was a lane or a couple of them to throw rocks. How fun would that have been? I would have loved to have gone to Central just for that reason. But I'm so curious about places that tell good North Dakota stories. Last year, I spent much time chasing them down by visiting all of the curling clubs in North Dakota. And I found out that not only is curling alive and well and kicking and rolling, but its popularity has migrated south to places like Fargo and Bismarck and Dickinson, and even farther south to states like Oklahoma, Texas, and Arizona. I mean, imagine that, going down to Arizona, not catching some rays outside, but going inside to curl on a sheet of ice. Well, our opera houses are very similar to curling clubs, just another way to hunt for histories. And so far what I've gathered is that all are, one, nearby railroads. Two, they attracted talent from faraway places like magicians and vaudevillian actors and mind readers and comedians. And three, at the same time, they've provided a place for locals to congregate to discuss local issues. But sadly, as I've discovered, most of these opera houses have closed or been condemned and demolished. That's not what's interesting to me. What's more interesting is the ones that have remained open and continue to be a hearth. Though the Grand Forks Opera House, the Metropolitan, it was once upon a time called, is no longer opened, it does still stand. It is still there in all its glory. And it still calls out to people passing by. One of those people is Susan Carraher, Grand Forks Historic Preservation Commission member. She knows it like it's one of her long-lost relatives.
If I can read you one very short passage. So on the opening night of the Metropolitan Opera House, the North Dakota governor at the time presided over the opening, and his dedication speech, this is North Dakota Governor John Miller, and I think he sums up exactly what this meant to the community. He said, "The formal opening of this magnificent auditorium, which is this night dedicated to music and the thespian art, puts behind us the primitiveness of the frontier and brings us to a new period of enlarged and increased social advantages that are really metropolitan." And I think that sums up the intent of the city leadership in putting together the financing and the effort to build the Metropolitan Opera House. Our commission works between the city and the state, and we look after all of the historic assets for the city and learn about new ones as they come of age.
What are some of those old historic buildings here in Grand Forks, North Dakota?
So it's interesting. We've just been looking at some of the downtown buildings, and as many would know, we've lost a lot of historic buildings, but those that we still have, we're really keen to highlight and preserve. So some folks might be familiar with the St. John's Block, the old state mill, which turned 100 years old a couple of years ago. Lots of the UND campus is still part of a historic district. And recently we've added a new district. So we have five districts altogether. We also are now looking more at the mid-century products as well. So 1945 to 1970 buildings are now coming of age too.
Do you have a favorite period of preservation?
A lot of my research since I've been with the commission has been in that mid-century period. So I feel like I've learned a lot about Grand Forks locally in that period. I nominated some of our mid-century schools to the National Register. So I got to learn a lot about education in Grand Forks locally, and that was really fun and really, really interesting. As the city kind of went through its next boom period after the war and the interwar period, so there was a lot of activity that moved the city southward, And so it's interesting to kind of follow the pattern of architecture throughout the city and see these periods of expansion and what triggered that and what was the infrastructure that came along with not just the population, but the schools and the churches and the commercial areas. It might interest people to know that we had the first indoor mall here in Grand Forks, the first one in North Dakota, and that was the Kmart Mall.
When you talk about that particular period of time, that 1940s, 1930s on up, one name that just is, if you're from Grand Forks or North Dakota, that will pop up is DeRemer. And not too far from here, there's one of his houses. There's a golf course at Lincoln that was, I think, part of the DeRemer architecture. Some of the schools, Viking Elementary, has DeRemer tacked onto it. But of course, one of our most famous buildings would be what?
If we're talking about Joseph Bell DeRemer, because he had a firm with his son, Samuel, and together they spanned a great period of time in Grand Forks, but also regionally. Joseph Bell DeRemer was commissioned to design the state building in the state capitol in Bismarck after it burned down unexpectedly. And so that is an Art Deco building that has his architectural design. But locally, the United Lutheran Church on Cottonwood Street is most recognizable, and that is a Joseph Bell DeRemer design as well.
If you're just tuning in, this is a Great American Folk Show. I'm Tom Brusso. We're visiting with Susan Carraher. She is part of the Grand Forks Historic Preservation Commission. Now, we're talking about famous buildings here in Grand Forks, North Dakota. One of them, in particular, is why I'm here today to visit you, is the Opera House. I believe it's called the Metropolitan Opera House. This has been around for many years, over 100 years, in fact. And it's part of North Dakota, Grand Forks' identity. It's right downtown, right by Woodman's Chocolate. Railroad track goes right by it. I'm so mystified by the opera houses that we have in this state. There are quite a few of them that are still around. And this one is really beautiful. And there it sits still. We're so lucky to have it. What can you tell us about that building, Susan?
It is a beautiful building. And it's not the first opera house in the city, but it was... The land for that opera house was donated by James J. Hill, who was the magnate of the Great Northern Railroad. And he donated the land for that opera house, and it sits right, as you said, on the railroad. It was built in 1890. It's a three-story Richardsonian Romanesque building, so it has that really heavy red masonry feel about it. It's really grand. And at the time that it was built, it would have been a remarkable sight in Grand Forks because we had perhaps 5,000 people living in the city at that time. And the Opera House itself had a seating capacity of about 900. So it was a significant investment in the city that was undergoing a boom at the time. And there were about 38 of the city business leaders who got together and formed the Grand Forks Opera House Company and wanted to make this really significant investment in this boomtown. So we've got the railroad that's coming through, the steamboats have been up and down the river doing trade for many years. It's a hub for transportation. And at the time, there's a massive increase of folks coming from the east through this part of the country. Some of them stayed here and others moved on. But the Opera House served really as this beacon of an optimistic future for Grand Forks. And I think even the name, Metropolitan Opera House, it was supposed to be this conduit to other metropolitan areas in the country that served the same kind of entertainment and social and cultural opportunities. So it was a real draw card for a lot of entertainment that came through Grand Forks by rail. And you mentioned it being on the railway. It was a convenient place for railway cars to stop and unload their scenery, their production equipment, their cast, their instruments. And it also brought a lot of people from the region that would come to visit Grand Forks and attend the shows here. So from that perspective, it was a really significant heartbeat of the community, and it brought a lot of people to town, whether temporarily or permanently. And it was one of the most significant investments that Grand Forks community leaders made during that period.
What is the Opera House like today?
The 1940s, a lot of the structure of the entertainment part of the Opera House was removed, and apartments were built upstairs, and they still exist today. So it has changed purpose over the years and became a bowling alley and a cafe and a bar and lots of different functions since it was an opera house, but still remained as sort of a hub of entertainment. I've been in the Opera House since it was then converted to a restaurant. When you go in there, you don't necessarily see any of the old doors and the lobby, but you still get a sense of its grandeur and its character as an important, significant place in the city.
Well, thank you, Susan Carraher. It has been so much fun. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Tom, my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
They put a parking lot on a piece of land where the supermarket used to stand. Before that, they put up a bowling alley on the site that used to be the local pally. That's where the big band used to come and play. My sister went there on a Saturday. Come dancing. All our boyfriends used to come and call. Why not come dancing? It's only natural.
You just heard my visit with Susan Carraher of the Grand Forks Historic Preservation Commission about the Metropolitan Opera House downtown Grand Forks. It's still there right by the railroad tracks, right next to Whitman's Candy. It's been 134 years, and it still has all of that allure. This guy by the name of Casey Opsted, he's an artist. Actually, I went to school with him. He invited me to the Metropolitan Opera House just last week to perform a few songs for his private gathering. I'm from Grand Forks, in case you didn't know. Would you believe it was only my third time walking through those doors? I almost can't even believe that. So I thought it'd be fun to play a bit of a recorded track from that evening, a song that I wrote with another friend of mine from this area, Hillary Kempenich. The song is called Oh River Flow, and I think that you'll be able to hear the room. You'll be able to hear the old Metropolitan Opera House. And that's one of the things that I love about performing music in places like that. It's like those old places get to speak a little bit too. They react to the music.
Old River Flow. Thank you.
something so grand. Life is a speck in a cup of your hand. Give room
was Tom Brousseau performing at what once was, and in many ways still is, the Grand Forks Metropolitan Opera House. You can catch the Great American Folk Show on the radio right here on Prairie Public, or streaming every Saturday at 5 p.m. Central, or you can sign up for the podcast and listen anytime at prairiepublic.org or wherever you get your favorites.
Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances, all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
This is Bird Note. If there is a single bird that captures the imagination of birders, it may be the harpy eagle. Harpy eagles are huge, powerful hunters that spend their lives in tall, remote tropical forests in Central and South America. Named for the harpies of Greek mythology, gruesome women with the bodies of birds, these eagles fly from tree to tree in search of food, rarely venturing into the open sky above. Feathered in varying shades of gray with a white belly, the harpy has a strong hooked beak and distinctive tall feathers that stand out straight from its head. Harpy eagles are massive. Females, larger than males, are 3.5 feet long and weigh up to 20 pounds. That's heavier than the largest bald eagle. Their rear talons measure a full 5 inches, ideal for plucking sloths and monkeys from the trees. Harpy eagles may not be the hounds of Zeus, but they are legendary in their own right. However, human persecution and ongoing cutting of forest are threatening these eagles, who raise just one nestling every 2 or 3 years. So each one is precious and spectacular. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 13th. Modern Woodmen of America is the third largest fraternal benefit society in terms of assets and has grown to over 700,000 members. The name was inspired by pioneer woodmen who cleared forests to build homes and communities and provide security for their families. The association sponsors activities and supports community projects, but it's best known for providing life insurance to its members. This brought the organization into the headlines when a member died and his wife had to sue to receive his insurance benefits. On this date, in 1926, the Bismarck Tribune reported that modern woodmen had filed an appeal with the state Supreme Court in the case of McEnany versus Modern Woodmen. Patrick McEnany had purchased a life insurance policy with modern woodmen in 1894. When he passed away in 1925, his widow expected to receive the life insurance payout. However, the organization refused to pay, claiming that Patrick McEnany was not a member in good standing at the time of his death. McEnany had filed for disability benefits the previous December, received a check, and deposited it in the bank. By doing so, he ended his membership with the Woodmen, and his life insurance was no longer in effect. When Mrs. McEnany applied for her husband's death benefits, the organization refused, stating he was not a member in good standing. So she took them to court. At first, the case seemed clear-cut in favor of the Woodmen, but there was a complication. McEnany had signed the papers and returned them to the Woodmen, and they, in turn, had sent a check to him. He had even deposited the check in the bank. However, there was a catch. At that time, a check deposited in the bank took time to clear. The bank notified the Woodmen that they needed to send the money to cover the check, but that took time. The check had still not cleared when McEnany died, so the contract had not been completed. The judge ruled in favor of Mrs. McEnany. The Woodmen appealed the decision to the North Dakota Supreme Court, which affirmed the lower court's ruling. Mrs. McEnany finally received her money. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Listen to Asian View from NHK World Japan Radio every weekday on the station to hear international news, interviews, and deep analysis of what's making headlines with a spotlight on what's happening in Japan and elsewhere in Asia. From the latest stories coming out of China, North Korea, and Myanmar, tune in to Asian View from NHK World Japan Radio and stay up to date with a region that's playing an increasingly important role.
Listen to Asian View weekday afternoons at 5:44 Central on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you have spent part of your Monday with us. Tomorrow on the show, Dr. Mary Houston, president of the North Dakota Speech Language Hearing Association, dives into the vital role speech and language pathologists play in North Dakota's healthcare and education systems. She'll talk about workforce challenges, legislative impacts, and the rise of telepractice, along with efforts to expand early intervention services and foster professional development. That's coming tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.